With Jesse Crenshaw, Lexington, Kentucky, February 9, 2001, with Kate Fossil. Okay, why don't you just start by giving me a little sort of personal background, your birth date, where you were born, where you grew up.
I was born in Metcalf County, Kentucky, in 1946, and lived and worked on a farm for my young adult part of my life. Mm-hmm. And went to school in Glasgow, Kentucky for high school, went to Kentucky State University, and went to University of Kentucky's College of Law.
Mm-hmm. And would you mind telling me a little bit about your family? Were your roots many generations in Kentucky?
To the best of my knowledge, all of my family have been from Kentucky. This is my brother Braxton. There are other family members, I'm sure, that lived outside of Kentucky. My father lived in Detroit, Michigan, most of his life, but mm-hmm. in terms of where everyone was from, they were from the Metcalf County, Barron County area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about, you said you have one brother, did you have many siblings?
There were four of us, I had three brothers.
Okay. And then what about your religious background? Were you raised in the church?
I'm Baptist.
You're Baptist still?
Yes, ma'am.
What about just a little bit more detail on your family history? Are you married?
I've been divorced for several years. Was married, yes.
Children?
No children.
Okay. Can you just talk about some of that material that you mentioned that day in the Civil Rights Symposium with regard to your experience of growing up in a segregated South?
I can't remember word for word what we were talking about that date, because that's been, 2 years ago or so, a year and a half ago?
Yeah, I think about
it. But at least when I was growing up, in the elementary school that I attended was 3 miles from where I lived. The nearest elementary school was 1 mile from where I lived. The nearest elementary school was segregated and all white. The elementary school that I attended was, as I say, 3 miles mm-hmm. away, and thus three times as far from where I lived than where the nearest school was, and it was segregated and all black. The nearest high school was 3 miles away and segregated and all white. And the high school that I attended was in Glasgow, Kentucky, and 20 miles away, one way, and segregated. And we were bused 20 miles one way and 20 miles back for a 40 miles round trip, 5 days a week to go to school, mm-hmm. when the nearest high school was 3 miles away.
Mm-hmm. And what about any other incidents that you could recall that were sort of trigger incidents with regard to like differential treatment based on color when you were a very young person?
There were many of those. I can remember going to Glasgow, Kentucky, and the Plaza Theater, it was named. And if you wanted to go to the movies, in fact, it was just the practice that all blacks went to the balcony and never were to go down to the lower level. And I can remember, I don't know how many years of going up and not being able to go down until at some point, and I don't remember the year, when it was acceptable for blacks to go to the down level. And I do not remember a movie being playing, but I remember being able to go in on the ground level and see it for the first time, as opposed to having never been on the lower level, as best I remember now. And that's been so many years, it's hard for me to remember. But I can just remember the difference in the way that the auditorium looked on the ground level, as opposed to parts of the auditorium that you'd never been able to see while you were on the second level. There were segregated places where you went to get food or to get a lunch or whatever, where you were allowed to go in. Well, there were places I can remember vaguely having to go to a side door or a side window to pick up your food. I can also remember other places where you could go in and pick up the food, but you had to leave. Mm-hmm. You know, there was not a go in, sit down, have the meal, as other customers were doing inside the restaurant.
Well, pardon my unfamiliarity with that area of Kentucky, but was it a significant African American population? I mean, were there alternatives to that in the black community, in other words?
Well, you've asked two questions. One was whether there was a large black population. And, compared to what I think you're asking, no, it was a small black population. And this is going by a long, long time ago. And some of this is vague in my memory. But seemingly around 1964 or that time, there might have been 1,500 or 2,000 blacks in Glasgow, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. Now, Glasgow would have had maybe, at most, 8,000, 10,000 population total, mm-hmm. and probably 1,500 or less in terms of its black population. Now, that's where I attended high school, but you also have to keep in mind that a large part of my growing up was on a farm in Metcalf County, half of the farm in Metcalf, half of it in Barron County. And if you're looking at the number of blacks within the various farming area, then you're talking about a much smaller ratio, probably, of blacks to whites. But even there, everybody is so spread out mm-hmm. that it's not like you've got some kind of great population influxion mm-hmm. With people. But anyway, in terms of just the overall Glasgow surrounding area, you're not talking about a 50-50 number of people or anything like that.
What did y'all raise, by the way?
We raised tobacco, corn. We had cattle, we had cows that were milked, we had all kinds of things that my grandfather sold to various stores and markets. He sold Kentucky Wonder beans, Hickory Cane corn, tomatoes, lettuce, butter beans.
How many acres?
168 acres.
Okay.
Half of it approximately in Metcalf County, and the other half in the Barron County. Mm-hmm. They were right on the Metcalf County, Barron County line, and half of it was in one, half was the other. He had a 4-acre and 3,900 tobacco base at the time. It was acreage then rather than poundage. And for 168 acres, that was a considered a very large tobacco base for that small amount of land.
Is that land still in your family?
No, it's not. It's still there and still farmed, but no, it was my father and my aunt sold the farm some years after my grandfather's death.
Would you consider your family like race men and race women? I mean, was there a lot of like black newspapers and was it a politically conscious kind of upbringing, would you say?
Well, you asked at least more than one question that's sort of separate there.
Okay.
When you use the word race men, what are you asking?
Well, that's just a phrase that some people have used to me in terms of a kind of a race man indicating often like very well-read in with the black press and just like sort of a kind of consciousness in that generation, like I guess your parents' generation, that was just sort of not... maybe not so actively opposing segregation, but teaching a real race consciousness certainly to their children. And I've noticed in a lot of interviews that really did come up about like reading the crisis, like the crisis might have been lying around the house a lot or that sort of thing.
Now you're talking about more than one thing. If you I haven't explained this to you. My mother and my father lived on the part of the land that was in Barron County.
Mm-hmm.
My grandparents lived on the part of the land that was in Metcalf County.
Mm-hmm.
My father decided to sell or to allow my grandfather to buy the portion that was in Barron County. My mother was an elementary school teacher, and they and I lived there a short period of time. My father had previously, prior and many years before, my understanding, worked in Detroit, Michigan in the automobile industry. At some point in time, he decided that he no longer wanted to farm, and he decided that he was going back to Michigan to work for the automobile industry. My mother and my brothers, for a very short period of time, lived in Michigan. And I suppose I was there for a year. I remember being there, but not for very long.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and lived in Kentucky with my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
At some later point in time, my mother and my brothers moved to Glasgow, and my father remained in Michigan.
Awesome.
And so when you're asking about who was well-read, not as well-read, my grandfather had a second grade education, so when you're talking about large numbers of race conscious reading materials, we're talking about a totally different thing.
Mm-hmm.
My mother is a very well read person, and I'm sure read numerous things.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're talking about my grandfather, especially, and my grandmother, because you ask a number of questions. You ask about race, and then you ask about politically conscious,
mm-hmm.
and those are very different questions and very different things. Both my grandfather and my mother were very well involved in terms of concern about politically active matters. My grandfather worked in many, many political campaigns. My mother worked in every campaign that I can think of in Glasgow, my grandfather in Metcalf County.
Mm-hmm. Were those Democratic campaigns?
Yes, mm-hmm. those were Democratic campaigns. So in terms of being exposed to the importance of matters that affected electing candidates and government and the impact of that, then both of them were very active in conveying information to us. Mm-hmm. In terms of teaching you to be proud of the fact that you were black and proud of the things that you could accomplish and all of that, well, you know, my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, all were active in encouraging that. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're talking about whether my grandfather was always sitting with a particular the Louisville Defender or something, mm-hmm, to use mm-hmm. as an example, then no.
I see.
My mother would have probably had such things from time to time, but I think I know in the sense of my mother and my grandfather, my grandmother to a lesser degree, the instilling in you that if you want to become whatever you want to become, you can accomplish that if you're willing to work hard and accomplish it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We were never taught that because you were black that you couldn't go on to be whatever you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. Who were some of your heroes or heroines growing up?
My grandfather, my mother.
Do you remember other figures like in the kind of popular culture, the larger world?
Well, you're asking me to try to remember, you know, 40 to 50 years ago. I don't remember back that far as to whether I had a Frederick Douglass that I aspired to be like.
Mm-hmm.
I can't. I mean, Douglass is one of my favorites as a person now, but I'd never heard of Frederick Douglass until I was, you know, out of college and mm-hmm. in the Army reading black history related things.
Hmm.
But in terms of, oh, our high school was named after Ralph Bunch. I mean, we knew about Ralph Bunch, but, you know, having large numbers of when you're talking about heroes, I mean, you're talking in terms of as if I were sitting around reading about Marcus Garvey and all of that. I think that's what you're
or
asking.
Or maybe even somebody like Jackie Robinson or...
Well, yeah, you knew of a Jackie Robinson. You mm-hmm. knew of those things, but I mean, you saw those as just a part of history. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know that I sat around patterning myself to someday I'm going to grow up and be a such and such.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I decided when I was 15 that I wanted to be a lawyer. I didn't pattern it after, you know, I'm going to be like Thurgood Marshall.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Now, somewhere in probably college, I might have started learning more about Thurgood Marshall and that sort of thing.
So help me with the years here. What year would it have been that you went to Kentucky State?
I attended Kentucky State from 1964 to 1968.
Mm-hmm.
Either August or September of 64 till June of 68.
So that would have been a at least somewhat politically active campus.
Well, much of what Martin Luther King was doing in the 60s was going on while I was in school. So mm-hmm. yes, during that period of time, I would have read and learned of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Stokely Carmichael mm-hmm. and all of the different people.
Well, does it go back before that in terms of your, like, I don't know, middle school or high school, in terms of when you became aware of the civil rights movement? That there was a movement?
Well, I was aware of segregation mm-hmm. Because of the things that my grandparents, my mother, and others taught us about adjusting to life in terms of, you know, there are things you can do and can't do because of segregation. Mm-hmm. But you must keep in mind that when you're out here in on a farm, milking cows twice a day, doing all the things that you were doing, you know, it's kind of like you were asking about earlier, the presentation at the History Center. That evening you heard Gerald make references to what was going on in an urban center.
Mm-hmm.
You heard Eleanor make reference to what was going on in an urban center. There's not that many, you know, protest marches out on a farm.
Right. I guess what I'm trying to understand is how you took that in, what that meant to you. Did it just seem all very far away then? You know what I mean? Like, I grew up on a farm as well.
I don't think it seemed... What years now? Are we at 64? Or are we back at young adulthood and childhood?
I'm thinking more when you were still at home.
Well...
Earlier.
You have to understand, when I was 13 years of age, my grandfather was leasing part of the tobacco base to a white farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And at 13, my grandfather was saying to me, "Here's what I want you to have Mr. So-and-so do today."
Mm-hmm.
So at 13, I was, as a 13-year-old who was black, saying to a 50-some-year-old white man, "This is what my grandfather wants you to do today."
Mm-hmm.
And that white man was saying, "All right," and was going on and doing it.
Right.
And at 13, my grandfather would send me from Knobbleg to Glasgow to buy fertilizer, grains, all kinds of things that he needed for planting and things that he needed for the farm. And I was going from the farm with my uncle driving the vehicle and going into the Southern States cooperative store and saying, "These are the things my grandfather sent me to get." And they were saying, "Where do you want us to load them up?" And they were put in the vehicle, and I signed for the thing and went on home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So at the same time that you had segregation, I never had the feeling that I couldn't do what I was supposed to do mm-hmm. in life. Prior to going off to college, I worked at a hospital there, the T.J. Sampson Community Hospital. And it was an interesting experience there, in which even though you had no legal segregation per se, they had a wing of the hospital that was where all black people were put. Black people and poor whites were put on that wing of the hospital. And when I was working there, I was working as a janitor. And again, you know, this is segregation in its segregation and discrimination in its, you know, most blatant form.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened at the T.J. Sampson Community Hospital, there was a man there, Mr. Henderson, I believe was his name, and he was a janitor, and he always kept his floors just as spotless. And so I worked just as hard at 16 years of age as he did, and kept the area that I was assigned just as well. Well, there were a number of people who would go in and play cards. And in the hallway in the basement, there were three different locker rooms. Four different locker rooms. The first one on the farthest end said women. No, it said ladies. I take it back. It's the furthest one said ladies. The next one said women, the next one said men, and the one that was the furthest up said gentlemen. And the one that said men, by and large, were black males who had their lockers in there. There might have been one or two whites, but almost all black. And blacks and whites would congregate in there at different times and play cards and gamble. Well, I, being a 16-year-old who had no interest in gambling and no desire to gamble, would go sometimes when the entire room, the entire locker room was overflowing with blacks and whites, and so sit in the, or, you know, take my break in the one that said gentlemen. Well, anyway, there was a time when the supervisor of the janitors, a Mrs. Parrish, came to me and said, there's been some complaints about you using the white men's restroom. And I, as a 16-year-old, had no idea where the white men's restroom were or was, because of the fact that on the wing that I did my work, which was this one that was predominantly black and a few poor whites, you had both whites and blacks using the two restrooms that were available. And this wing of the hospital had both men and women, so in some areas you'd have black women and some areas you'd have black men, and you'd have white women in some rooms and white men in other rooms. But anyway, both blacks and whites used the restroom that were on this end of the hallway, and the one that was on the very end up here was sometimes used by both blacks and whites. And so as I cleaned up those, I had, you know, never known that there was a difference. And so, and then when you came in front of the hospital, there was a restroom out there that was used by both white and black visitors. So when she told me that there'd been a complaint about me using the white men's restroom, it befuddled me for quite a spell there, 30, 40 minutes, the morning that she told me that. And so I went back to her later and asked her, you know, Ms. Parrish, where is the white men's restroom? And she then explained that it was the locker room where Mr. Parrish, I mean, Mr. Henderson and them, used. And so I explained to her that if I was not good enough to use the white men's restroom, then I certainly was not good enough to clean it up. And so her explanation to me, this was in 1963, that there was nothing racial intended. There was no, you know, intent for race whatsoever. And so she said to me that I should go home and talk with my parents, think about this, and then let her know, come back and let her know what I decided. So I went home and told my mother, and I was at this point living in Glasgow, I was not living on the farm anymore. And so I suppose now, this is my speculation, Ms. Parrish had felt that if I talked to my parents that I'd be told, you must accept this, that as a poor black, then you will need the money and that you must accept it and you must go ahead and do what we tell you. Well, I explained it to my mother, and my mother hit the ceiling, went through the roof. And rather than say you should accept this, it was the same thing I had said, you know, you should quit, you know, they should not even think that you're going to work there when they're saying all that.
Could I interrupt? What was the name of the hospital again?
T.J. Sampson Community Hospital.
So, and was it a public hospital?
Yes, ma'am. Receiving federal funds.
Right.
Yes, ma'am. Well, anyway, I went back, and the next day was always as amusing as could be, because we started work at 7 o'clock in the morning, and usually by 8:30 at the latest, Ms. Parrish would make her rounds to observe and make known that, you know, she was in the area. Anyway, she was the supervisor of both the janitors and the maids. So anyway, that particular day after I'd gone back to work, It was, and that day was amusing too. Rather than be assigned to where I'd been working, I was assigned up on the third floor, way over in another area that I normally didn't work. And so instead of her coming by at the usual interval that she would come by to make sure that everybody saw and was working hard and saw her and her presence. Well, anyway, it was like, I'm guessing, this is a guess, 11:15 or something before she ever came up on the third floor. And so she came over to me and she asked me, and I talked with my parents and I told her I had. She asked me what I had decided. And I said, well, Miss Parents, I'm going to have to quit. And she said, well, if you're going to have to quit, then before you do that, Mr. Kimball, who was the administrator of the hospital, Mr. Kimball wants to talk with you. So anyway, it was kind of just totally amusing to me because there was a portion of the hospital, what they call the chapel, that was utilized for funerals whenever someone died and they didn't have any other place to have the funeral service. They would. And so the chapel doubled as both a conference room and an area. And there was this very, very beautiful, long, dark wood conference table. And then over further to the side was the sort of chapel, religious area. And I said funeral. I don't know if it was a funeral or if it just had religious services in there for patients that wanted to have service but couldn't leave the hospital. I don't know. It might have just been that. But anyway, this was such a significant area that Ms. Parris always cleaned the chapel herself. She never allowed the maids or the or any of the janitors to clean it. And I'm trying to remember, it was some outlandishly small amount of money per hour that she earned.
That she did?
No, that I did.
That you did.
And I cannot remember whether it was like 50 cent an hour or 60 cent an hour, but some outlandishly small amount of money. But anyway, and it's so funny, she explained to me that I had to meet with Mr. Parris, so we go down to the conference room, and we're at this beautiful conference table. Mr. Parris sits at the head of the table, and I sit to his right. He had me sit to his right. And it was very amusing to me because I was 16 years of age. I'd been working there for a long time. And I'd never been allowed in the conference room until we were talking about whether the hospital was, and nobody ever said this, but the real conversation was whether the hospital was about to get sued for racial discrimination. And it wasn't about, you know, anything else. Because if you're receiving federal funds, the last thing you want is some 16-year-old black kid to file suit against you for racial discrimination. So anyway, we're sitting down there, and Mr. Parris goes through a 30-minute at least conversation, and it was always, and I always remember this, when you're cleaning the hallways and you're mopping and you're waxing and all, and Mr. Parris would come through, the most you would get would be a grunt, and that was a very, very expansive greeting from him. Usually it was not even an acknowledgement that you were there as he came down the hallway. So here's a man who at his best would barely grunt to you as an acknowledgement or as a greeting. And now here we are down in the conference room with him at the head of the table and me to the right. And so he spends at least 30 minutes explaining to me what life was. And one of the phrases that he mentioned was that there was, he went through all of this about his children and his wife and his family and the various, as to use his words, colored people that they knew and had interacted with and all. And the phrase that he used was, when he got through summarizing all these racial differences and distinctions is what he was really trying to explain. The phrase that he used near the end was, now there are some things in life that you just can't change. And it was almost amusing to me because, you know, at 16 I knew that that was not true. I knew there were many things you could change. And the reason that that didn't bother me at all when he was saying it was because all of my childhood had been one in which my grandfather and all of my family had taught me you could do anything you wanted to do, you could become anything you wanted to become. And I'm trying to think, by that time I had already graduated from high school and graduated valedictorian of my class, and so, you know, it wasn't like I was, you know, intimidated by the room, by him, or, you know, any of that. And one of the things that really, really was also noteworthy, he was going through all of the various comparisons between black people and white people, and he was pointing out that his wife did not work, and that she stayed home and kept their children and, you know, made sure their children were well cared for. And as he was explaining that, it was, you know, something that I thought about and really thought how stupid it was for him to be using all of the explanation the way he was explaining it. Because as he was comparing the fact that his wife got to stay home and, you know, have the ideal set of circumstances in terms of rearing their children, my mother was working at a chicken factory picking pin feathers and had to be at work at 4:30 in the morning, in the morning. And so, you know, as he was trying to explain all of the wonderful things that went on in he and his family's life, it was, you know, stupid,
right,
as you sat there knowing that as a result of the difference in economic standing, and as the difference of what was allowed economically for black people versus white people, that, you know, here my mother, who was an educator and a teacher, and had been an elementary school teacher prior to her going back to Michigan, is back here in Glasgow working in a chicken factory because the chicken factory paid more than being a teacher. And yet at the same time, he's telling me that there's some things in life that you just can't change. So it was very, very amusing to me. We go through all of this 30 to 45 minutes. And you have to keep in mind that 30 to 45 minutes to a man who would give you a grunt,
right,
all of the rest of the time that he worked with and around you is a huge amount of time. I mean, this is a man who barely would speak to you. So now here he is under the threat of the possibility of some federal intervention of adversely affecting their funds, that he's now got plenty of time and he's got all these personal things to tell you about life. And I'll never forget it. We get to the end and he looks over to me and he says, well, now what have you decided? And I said, well, Mr. Kimmel, I'm going to quit. And then the ultimate in stupidity on his part was stupidity to the extent that how he could have thought that I would have ever believed him, I don't know. We get to the end and he says, well, if you just quit, then I can't give you a recommendation in the future. If you work 2 weeks and give the proper 2-week notice, then I'll be able to give you a recommendation. And I thought to myself as he was saying it, how could he be so stupid? How could he think that I would be such a fool to believe that he will ever give me a favorable recommendation?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I worked 2 more weeks to pay off another payment on my car, and I quit.
Mm-hmm.
And I left there to go to work in construction. And went to work for the Ernest Simpson Construction Company and worked there until I left to go to college. And as I told the other people, other orderlies and janitors who worked there at the hospital, that I was going to work in construction, that I would not be back. And as one particular person told me, you'll be back, construction works extremely hard, and you'll be back. And I have been back to the T.J. Sampson Community Hospital as visiting patients, but I've never been back there to work. And another interesting part, there was another lady, and I cannot remember her name now, but she was not officially a supervisor, but she was, I was helping her. I remember after this little incident about me going to quit, and after the, and I told her the same thing, that if I wasn't good enough to use the restrooms, I certainly wasn't good enough to clean them up. And she was, you know, cautioning me about how this was such a good job, and that this is another white lady, not a black lady. But anyway, she was explaining to me how that, you know, I might want to definitely stay there and leave the ability to come back if I ever needed a job there in the future. And I never envisioned that I would need a job there in the future. So when you ask me about discrimination, yes, I understand it. Yes, I was exposed to it. I did not feel then, nor do I feel now, that I would be under the problem that Mr. Kimball talked about, that there's some things in life that you just can't change. I mean, when you're 13 and telling a 50-some-year-old white man, this is what you must do today, this is what your job is to be, this is what you're to do, then when you're being told at 16 that there's some things in life you can't change, you know, you don't haul off and start yelling and screaming at the man. You simply, I didn't blow it off at all.
Well,
you simply tell him, no, I cannot work for you any longer. So, in terms of the way I have approached life as best I could, you know, I had at 15 decided I wanted to become a lawyer. Now, to become a lawyer, you must go to college or graduate from college. You must go to law school. You must graduate from law school. So it wasn't like that, you know, I had some inability to understand the things that can be done. And again, it goes back to my grandfather, and it goes back to my mother teaching us that education was extremely important, teaching us that hard work will enable you to do what you want to do, and that you can accomplish what you want to do if you try.
Mm-hmm.
The best thing I can try to explain to you, if it helps any, is having been to Louisville many years ago, this was many, many years ago, at the Humana building. And the entrance, and have you ever been to the Humana building?
That new one, the Marvel?
No, this is many years ago.
Yeah,
the one that had all of the beautiful green marble.
I've never been in
there. Well, I mean, have you been to the entryway? You've never seen the outside of it?
Okay. No, only from a distance.
Well, it's a very, very striking, beautiful entryway. Now back then, once you got inside, it didn't look anywhere near as elaborate as it did there at the entryway. Now the new one, I don't know what it looks like.
It's striking at the entryways.
Right? Well, and it was always, and it's the same thing when I go to large cities that have equally beautiful architecture. When I enter a center of power, I am impressed with its beauty, but I'm not awed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm neither awed nor overwhelmed with it. And so, as the years have progressed, when I try to do things to help improve the lives of people, you know, I see it as something that anyone can do who's willing to work hard and put their man to doing it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it's like when I went to law school. I mean, I didn't have any feeling that, you know, this is something that I won't be able to accomplish or achieve. I've worked here in Fayette County at least since 1973 in various political campaigns for person after person after person. And as a result, you know, you don't have this feeling of, well, my goodness, if I try to do this, I can't do it.
Right, right. So, I was curious about this this incident you described with the hospital, if you already made up your mind before that to become a lawyer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, uh-huh. I made up my mind. My little deciding to make up my mind was fun. My grandfather had always taught us that you should be your own boss, as he put it. And it revolves around being self-employed. So every morning when I'd go out there to get the cattle, to drive the cows in for us to milk the cows, one morning it was a beautiful dew and mist on the ground, and beautiful sunshine reflecting off of that, and it was beautiful. And the cows were out there grazing, and they didn't want to be bothered or pestered at all. And it finally dawned on me, these cows don't want to have to be brought in here to milk. And there's got to be more for me in life than bringing these cows in every morning and milking these cows every day. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it wasn't like that. And at that point, I then decided, you know, if I'm going to be my own boss, then what should I become? Mm-hmm. And my mother and my aunt and others, family members, had been teachers. So you had my grandfather as a farmer and my grandmother as a farm person. And, you know, myself working in farming from the time I was 11 until whatever age that was, 15, 4 years. And so the only careers that I knew of then was either being a lawyer, a doctor, or a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so as a doctor, I didn't feel I could stomach the blood and all that went with being a doctor, at least I thought there was a lot of blood with it. And since I was scared of blood, I couldn't become a doctor. Being a teacher, which I now am in terms of teaching at a university level. And I didn't, at that age, think that teaching was the wisest thing, because you always had to go to summer school to keep working on all of your certification. So to my way of looking at it, you didn't want to become a teacher because it ruined your summers. So, but teaching at a university level doesn't ruin your summer, right. I might add.
Right. No,
so,
I like it for that reason.
So, anyway, my choice was to become a lawyer, and I went from there working toward becoming a lawyer. Now, in terms of, I guess, what you would think of working in civil rights and all that kind of thing, my efforts have been, and there have been some civil rights kind of things, but part of the way I viewed life as a young person as well as now is that you have to work to change things, but you also, but anyway, my view of things is that you're better able to make changes if you are, in fact, one of the, back to my grandfather's philosophy, you need to be your own boss. Mm-hmm. And if you are able and are in positions that you make decisions, you're able to make a lot better improvements than if you're always on the outside. You know, I just see it as you know, one of my law professors, Professor Eugene Mooney, once taught us in constitutional law that the most important part of the decision is deciding who gets to decide. And so my way of viewing life is that you know, I like helping decide who gets to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was in law school, one of the things that a colleague of mine, I was a third year student and Harold Green was a second year student, and he was president of the Black American Law Students Association, and I was vice president of the law organization. And we decided that we were going to desegregate the law school's faculty, and we were going to do it because law school never had any blacks on it. So we talked with a black law professor at, it's West Virginia. I forget the exact title of the law school, but it's in Morgantown, West Virginia.
West Virginia University Law.
Okay. A fellow by the name of Franklin Cleckley, and Cleckley was a law professor and done a good job. At least, you know, as far as I know, I haven't seen him since, I guess now it's 1973.
Yeah, well, what year was this?
1973. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, we decided we were going to try to desegregate the faculty of the law school, and the reason being that we felt, or I felt especially, that black law students and white law students needed to see a black teacher. Black law students needed it because of the fact that we needed to see a positive reflection of our own self-image. And white law students needed to see it to see that, in fact, black law professors are, in fact, able and capable. And if my teacher was black, then other black lawyers are going to be just as capable as anybody else. So anyway, we went to the dean of the law school then, who was a man by the name of George Hardy, and asked Dean Hardy, had he ever considered hiring a black law professor? And he said, oh, yes, we tried. He pulled open the bottom of the drawer, and this was in good faith. I mean, he was not, you know, trying to stifle us in any way, form, or fashion. He pulled open his desk drawer, and he had all this list of files of people they tried to hire.
Mm-hmm.
So again, the most important part of the decision is deciding who gets to decide. So rather than going in saying, oh, please, please, we went in with the name of a specific person, namely Cleckley. And we had talked to Cleckley and asked Cleckley if he would consider coming to UK, and he said yes, but he had all these criteria that he wanted. Among those was $30,000 a year, full tenure, full professorship, and the right to practice law as much as he wanted to. So we asked Dean Hardy about having hired anybody or considered hiring. He said yes, he'd love to, but everybody he'd ever tried to get had turned him down. And we said, well, what about Frank Cleckley? And so we told him what Cleckley wanted. He said, my God, if I do that, all of the members of the faculty will quit because there's only two faculty members who are making anywhere close to that, and they've been here for years and years and years. So we negotiated from, I can't remember whether it was like May or March or whatever it was. We negotiated, I guess it had to have started around February or March, because I think it was like May when we finally leveled off. Well, anyway, Cleckley had told us he would come if we got him all these things. Well, finally Dean, and there were interviews, and Cleckley came, and the students loved him, and the course that we wanted him to teach was a four-hour class in evidence, and that we knew evidence was his specialty, and thus, it was a significant course that all the students had to take, and at least 50% of the people who took evidence would be in his section, and the others would be in Professor Lawson's section. So it would be at least half of the law students would always be taking this professor. Well, finally, about May, Cleckley told us that he had applied for general counsel of the Office of Civil Rights, and that he had to wait to see whether he was going to get that position, and he wouldn't know until May or some such. Well, anyway, Dean Hardy negotiated in good faith because he worked very hard to try to help us find, when Cleckley said no, a black law professor. And ultimately, a man by the name of William James was hired, and but it wasn't exactly the course that we had hoped for.
Mm-hmm.
James's area was legal bibliography. He was a law librarian. So he became the law librarian and came the first black law professor at the University of Kentucky's College of Law. Came in the fall of 1974. And in that sense, our efforts, desegregated the faculty of it. Now, and that was in 1973 when we first started, and then Bill James came that fall. I'm saying 73, it might have been. He might have come in the fall of 73 instead of the fall of, no, I'm telling you a story because I graduated in December of 73, so it was the August of 74 that he came. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, because I studied for the bar in February of 74, and right, it would have been 73 that we had the negotiations. And it would have been 74 mm-hmm. that he came. Because it might have been that we negotiated. I know what it was, yeah. We negotiated about Cleckley that spring. And then we worked on the situation with Bill James from August through that fall of 73. Well, anyway, 1978, and 4 years later, I was graduating and was at the U.S. Attorney's Office. 1978, I go back and I have a different dean, Tom Lewis. George Hardy had left, gone back to Texas, and was practicing law again. So I went in. I'm now an assistant United States attorney. And again, at the U.S. Attorney's Office, I'll come back to that in a moment, because I was the first black assistant U.S. attorney for the Eastern Judicial District here in Lexington. But anyway, I'm now working with the U.S. Attorney's Office as a federal prosecutor. And I go in, and this has had no authorization from the U.S. Department of Justice whatsoever. So I go in, I ask Dean Lewis, same phrase that I used in 73, have you all ever considered hiring a second black law professor? And Dean Lewis reached down at the same drawer, pulled out the same things, and said, we've worked and we've tried and we've tried and tried. But only now the salaries that the people were asking were like $45,000 a year and making much more money. And so the salaries of the people who had turned them down now, not the salaries mm-hmm. of the UK professors at that time. Well, anyway, Dean Lewis, again, negotiated in good faith. After we posed the request, the demand, as Frederick Douglass would have called it, he went forward, worked very diligently with me in trying to find a second black law professor. And the fellow we tried to get was a man by the name of Stanley Walker. We thought he had tried our best to get him. Stanley was leaving what was called the Roush Corporation, and the Roush Corporation developed shopping centers in inner cities, and especially in Baltimore, Maryland, was where they were located. Anyway, he was general counsel for the Roush Corporation, and I never can remember which order this was, either the undergraduate from Harvard and his law school from Yale or vice versa, and it worked in all kinds of different capacities, in small firms, large law firms, had done a stint with legal aid, and at that point was also general counsel for this Rouse Corporation that redeveloped inner city blighted areas. So he was leaving there, and his choices were down to UK and school in Florida, law school in Florida, and his wife had family from Florida. So I will say Dean Lewis whined and dined and worked to try to get Stanley Walker to come. We were not able to get Stanley Walker. We ended up with a different man, who came, and that became the second black law professor at the University of Kentucky's College of Law. And over the years, now I'm jumping back now to my efforts in terms of the work at the U.S. Attorney's Office. Patrick Malloy, who was the United States Attorney at the time, came to me and asked me if I would consider coming to work for the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I said yes. And Jimmy Carter was the President of the United States at the time. And it's my understanding now, I never saw this in writing, but when President Carter became president, it's my understanding that Carter made it known throughout government, I want to see more black people hired. Mm-hmm. And it's my guesstimate that that filtered down to U.S. attorneys as well as everything else. So when I went there in April of 1978, there had never, the office had been operating since 1901, and there had never been a black assistant U.S. attorney or U.S. attorney assistant or full-fledged U.S. attorney in the history of that office. Now, a few months before, maybe, I don't think it was as much as a year, but a period of time before I went there, a fellow by the name of Hansi Jones was the first black assistant U.S. attorney in the state. Mm-hmm. Now, he was over in the Western District in Louisville. And thus, in terms of the state, I would have been the second in the state, but in terms of this local Lexington office, I was the first black to ever work as a lawyer and as an assistant U.S. attorney. So, you know, later when I become a state representative from Fayette County and thus the first black, you know, state representative from Fayette County, it's not like with each of those that I saw them as something that I could never do or that it was an impossibility. You know, it's back to when Mr. Kimball was telling me that there's some things in life that you can't change. Well, that's not true. And it wasn't true then, and I knew it wasn't true. When you look at the Civil Rights Act of 1964, you know, that legislation that Martin Luther King was able to get enacted, you may not be able to change the hearts and minds of people, but you can change their conduct. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And through the utilization of the law, you can change their conduct. Now, you asked me earlier a question that I have to restate. Yes, it became clear to me at a young age that through the use of the law and a law degree and its impact, you can improve society, you can change society. Mm-hmm. And earlier, the way you asked the question, I don't think prompted me to think about what I guess you were actually asking. Yes, very young in life, the combination of my grandfather's admonitions about being your own boss, and that's why I decided at 15 to practice law, because what I was looking at was, one, you are able to go into business. Mm-hmm. The second part of it was, and this was a young person's way of looking at life, was that if I tried to become a lawyer and did not do as well in terms of, you know, becoming admitted to practice, that if I were going to go into business, then at least I would know what the law was. And if I hired lawyers, I'd at least know enough about the law to know when they were right and when they were wrong. Mm-hmm. But I never actually felt that I wouldn't be able to do it. Right. I, you know, felt confident I could accomplish what I wanted to do. And then the other part of it is, yes, it was very clear to me that if I had a law degree, I could, in fact, improve society. Mm-hmm. In the years that I've been practicing law since 1974, that's what I've tried to do with that skill and with that degree and with that license. Mm-hmm. I've tried to help everybody that I could. So in terms of teaching, I teach undergraduate criminal justice courses. So the use of the law is thereby helping other young people there.
Right.
The use of the law in representing clients is thereby helping people who need help. And in terms of the legislative end of it, the ability to have been trained in the law helps me very, very much in terms of understanding it, in terms of the ramifications of what can and can't be done.
Can you give me a kind of quick chronology of your career in legislative office, or in politics?
You're talking about being elected or being involved in political campaigns?
First being elected, and then I want to talk about political campaigns, or even like more like issues politics.
Okay. I was elected in November of 1992, took office in January of 1993, and I've served in the Kentucky General Assembly from 1993 to the present.
And was that the first elected office
yes.
in the world? Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
And so with regard to like, maybe you could just say a little bit about your impetus for doing that, you know, what sort of took you in that direction?
Well, in college I was a history and political science major, but I always looked at my political science professors and history professors, and by whatever choice, and a lot of academicians view things as they should be academicians.
Right.
They should not be practitioners
mm-hmm.
that were eloquent in recounting what other people have done. I, on the other hand, and maybe because of some of my grandfather's teachings, always felt that you should be able, and maybe one of his phrases, because he had many of them, one was you should practice what you preach. And it may have well been that to me, it's fine to be eloquent and recounting all of the historical things and everything, and the political activities, but if you're going to recount all that, you ought to be able to have some involvement and practical experience in
mm-hmm.
it. So as I teach students, I think I'm a much better teacher because I've left the courtroom 2 days before having to encounter just what I'm telling them about.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of political activities, in 1973, there was a mayoral race here in Lexington in which Foster Pettit was running for mayor, and he asked the same young man, Harold Green, and I to help in his campaign. Well, we started by trying to help register sanitation workers to vote. Another law school classmate of ours, not classmate, he wasn't a classmate of mine, he was a year behind me, but he asked Carol and I to go with him down to the sanitation department to help register people to vote, and we did. Well, we were standing there, and we've got 30 people or so in line being registered to vote, and then he says, well, I've got to leave, I've got to go to class. And we can't just leave 30 people standing there saying, you know, we've got to leave, so we continued and finished the registration. After that, we got involved in helping Mr. Pettit in his campaign. And so my grandfather, you asked me something earlier I never came back to, had been involved in campaign after campaign after
mm-hmm.
campaign. Well, as I've sat there as a 12-year-old watching him at fish fries and this and that and the other where he was working in whatever candidate's campaign, it became very, very natural as a, you know, young adult that working in mm-hmm. someone's campaign or being involved in the decision-making process made sense. And then later, as I said in my constitutional law class, when Gene Mooney was saying, you know, the most important part of the decision is deciding who
mm-hmm.
gets to decide, those things have a very nice fit because,
right.
and it's not philosophical, it's not standing back talking about here's what happened during the Pettit campaign. It's here's where we were out working, doing this task, the next task, and the next task. And I still do the same thing. I mean, I still, even when I'm not running for office, even when I'm, you know, unopposed or whatever, I try to help somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so from 73 to the present, I've helped numerous people in numerous races.
Well, knowing that you have to be somewhere at 7 and that
I said 7, but I really only want to be there till 8. But
talk about, maybe this would be a good juncture to just sort of digress a little and talk about your work with the Pritchard Committee. Okay. And how that kind of, you know, came about.
Well, I don't remember exactly who appointed me. I don't remember whether that was... I don't remember exactly. Mr. Pritchard, Ed Pritchard Jr. was mm-hmm. alive and was the chair of that committee.
Right.
It started out being entitled the Committee on the Future of Higher Education in Kentucky.
Right.
And later, I told you earlier, a long time ago, I think I served on it about 18 months is what I vaguely recollect. But anyway, somewhere around a year or so into it, it was renamed after Mr. Pritchard, which was so rightly deserving. And it was renamed the Pritchard Committee. But basically what it was and what we were trying to do was study how the future of higher education should be and what kinds of things the state of Kentucky should be trying to do in higher education. And I had been a faculty member at Kentucky State for a long time then. In fact, I was a teacher there from 74 to 78. And then when I left to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office, I told everybody that, you know, I would be gone between 2 years and 4 years and did not plan to make a career in the U.S. Department of Justice, but that I would be coming back to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And so it would have been somewhere after I went back, I would imagine, that I served on the Pritchard Committee. And we had many, many meetings over at Shakertown where we studied what the circumstances were in higher education and what we felt needed to be done and that sort of thing.
Well, as I understand, I think you weren't on that among the very first group of members, although I might be wrong about
that. Well, I may be telling, when I said 80s, I've got my years wrong because...
No, I think you're right about that. It started in 79.
Well, maybe it was 79.
In the fall of 79.
Okay, that's when it started.
And I know Lewis Coleman was also among that very original group. I'm not sure if he went to any of the meetings. But the reason I'm fidgeting around is I have a list of the...
it would have been after I left the U.S. Attorney's Office then. You're right, because... Name some of the people who you're listing. Lois Weinberg was on there, but Lois stayed a lot longer than I did. I'm sure she was on there even after I left for years and years.
And she's still on it, actually.
Who's on the list that you have? When Raymond Burst was on it at the time that I was there.
Pat Kafoglis.
Yeah, Pat Kafoglis was there.
I guess Dot Riding.
Dot Riding was there.
There, Barney Tucker.
Mr. Tucker was
there.
Wade Mounts was there. Now, was that the first group or a second group? Which one are you saying I was in?
Well, I think you came on pretty quickly. I really.
I was thinking that I was among, if not the first group, at least the very early.
That's what I think. So
early group.
I think not the very first meetings, but like still within that first 6 months to a year.
Right. Now that's what I would, now I think, that's what I recall. I mean, there were many, many articles and materials mm-hmm. and consultants that came to provide information for us to think about. And basically what the Pritchard Committee was trying to do was make recommendations on what the future of higher education should be. And I'm trying to remember, this is my recollection that Governor John Y. Brown Jr. was the governor at the time.
Right, that's right.
And it may have even been an appointment. I'm not sure if the governor's office made the appointments or how the appointment process came.
No, actually, I think they were, they came out of, I guess.
Council on Higher Education probably was the one.
And Bob Sexton was sort of hired as this particular
right.
project.
Bob Sexton
was the
deputy director of the Council on Higher Education at the time, as I recall. And Bob was assigned to this particular Council on Higher Education project.
So he and the man who was the director of the council,
Harry Snyder.
I guess they had, and Ned Pritchard, I think, had a lot of input
into those.
I do have you down as one of the original group. I was wrong about that. Well, it says actually recruited in 1980, so that was within the first, 6 months. It really didn't begin until the end of 79. So you were in that very early group when it was still dealing with issues of higher education,
right,
and when Ed
right.
Pritchard was really kind of holding.
Yeah, Mr. Pritchard I loved. I mean, I really, really enjoyed him. Mr. Pritchard, the three people that I consider to be the most analytical that I can recall, and that is my grandfather, Dr. Henry Ellis Cheney, who was a professor emeritus of Kentucky State University, and Mr. Pritchard, three of the most analytical men that I've ever had the good fortune to talk with at Lynn. My grandfather had a second grade education, could barely sign his name, but was as analytical and as insightful as probably anybody you'd ever want to talk to. And I had the good fortune of spending hundreds and hundreds of hours between the time I was a baby to the time he died. And then with Dr. Cheney, those 4 years in college, he was kind enough to answer any question, to stay for, there were times when I would go see Dr. Cheney at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and there would be one question after another and another until at 5 o'clock, his wife, Mrs. Cheney, would knock on the door saying, "Henry, we've got to go home." And he wouldn't have never become frustrated or irritated with my asking so many questions. In the same kind of way, Mr. Pritchard was extremely capable intellectually and loved analyzing and questioning and seeking the answers about higher education and I'm sure many other things.
Mm-hmm.
So the time that I spent on the Pritchard Committee was extremely rewarding in terms of, the probing about what should be done. Now, I will acknowledge now that in terms of being on the Pritchard Committee, Mr. Pritchard knew more about education than I could ever imagine.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably learned more than I gave in terms of contribution. I probably got more from being on there than I gave, but it was a very, very good. And again, now that we're talking tonight, it is much like serving in the General Assembly in the sense that there is so much information that's being conveyed and so many issues that are being looked at. So I hadn't thought about it until our sitting here tonight that duration of time of being a member of the Pritchard Committee probably helped a lot in terms of what I do now and what I try to do now.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting the way that so many of the people that were chosen for that early group, the preacher committee, have ended up being real movers and shakers in the state, although they weren't particularly, you know, established leaders, certainly not at that time. So to the extent that, would you say it was primarily your credentials with Kentucky State that might have been, you know, one of the things that drew them to select you, or were you involved in other education campaigns at that time, like in other aspects?
Now, this is a guess, and I have... Is it maybe? This is a guess, and I'm not sure. Part of it, I would speculate, would be a combination of things. And one, being a lawyer, mm-hmm. and having been a federal prosecutor, and being a university professor, in combination, my thinking would be that they were looking for someone who had the ability to help bring to the group insights that might not have otherwise been there. Because at that point in time, Raymond Burse was on the committee. Raymond came, as best I remember, after I did. I don't remember the exact date, but there was a point in time when he became a member, because I know we served, and I don't remember whether we were on there from the beginning together or whether he mm-hmm. came later, but my recollection was he came later. Well, in Raymond's instance, as best I recall at the time, he was, no, that's not totally true. Part of his credentials, I'm sure, was having been a Rhodes Scholar and all, but being a young black lawyer, and in my instance, again, a black lawyer and teacher, may have been, and I don't know what prompted the selections. You know, when you look out at it, and Harry Snyder, I really was impressed with in a very nice way. I told you earlier that there were a number of very, very capable people there on the committee, and it was always nice to be among folk who were very capable. But the day that you know that Harry knows what he's doing above and beyond, and he did it to impress us, I'm sure, all of the members of the Pritchard Committee, and then we were still under the old name, and we're sitting around the table, and we're all, I mean, it's a huge conference table. So instead of Harry introducing the members of the committee to the audience, and there's at least 50 people from this side all the way down and around across up here, Harry introduces every member of the audience and their title and what they did. Mm-hmm. So for purposes of establishing to the members of the committee that, yes, I am intelligent, I do know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. As the executive director of the Council on Higher Education, Harry got my attention. I was able to acknowledge that Harry knows what he's doing.
Well, when you first were on the Pritchard Committee dealing with issues of higher education, I think, and again, I haven't had a chance to consult my notes recently, but the sort of the future of Kentucky State was sort of part of those discussions, or...
Yes, but I don't think that came at the very beginning. I think that came at a later point in near the end of the time, or 6 months or so near the end of my mm-hmm. duration there, I think.
I just was curious to hear a little bit more about, you know, what those discussions... What were the discussions?
Well, I don't know that the Pritchard Committee itself, and again, we were talking about 20 years ago, I don't recall Kentucky State being specifically debated and discussed as a what are we going to do with Kentucky State. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, the Council on Higher Education, yes, and separate instances of the Council on Higher Education meeting, then yes.
Were you on the council?
No, I was never on the Council on Higher Education. And Raymond Burst, I don't remember whether he became a member of the Council on Higher Education. I don't remember whether he came to the committee at the exact same time that he was on there, mm-hmm. or whether he was on the committee and then became a member of the Council of Higher Education. But his another part of his coming to the committee may have had to do with the council. If he were on the Council of Higher Education, mm-hmm. at the time that he came on to the committee, then that would have obviously been a part of the reason why he came. Now, whether he was on the Pritchard Committee and then went to the Council of Higher Education, and that was a part of the reason why he got to that, I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It's been so many years ago.
I was also curious to know if there was any, if, you know, because I guess one of the things, if you read the news clippings from back around like the early 80s when the Pritchard Committee submitted its report and mm-hmm. it sort of, you know, the legislature just didn't really enact it
a lot of what
properly.
Recommended.
Right. So I wonder, I was curious if that, you know, had anything to do with your interest in getting into, you know, government in that way, you know, just that experience, because I know
no.
a lot of the interviews have talked about, the people have talked about.
No, it didn't. As I said earlier, my finally going into or running for political office, it was almost a common natural thing to do. As I said, I worked in every mayoral race in Fayette County from 1973 to the present.
Right.
I've worked in every presidential race. I've worked in many congressional races. I've worked in city council races. I've worked in judicial races. So it wasn't like that, and as I've told you before, I believe in practicing mm-hmm. being an active participant. So to run for office was not an unheard of,
mm-hmm.
you know, it wasn't like there was some big thing that said, oh my God, I think I'll do this
right,
today.
Shot in the dark. No.
No, it was a sort of a natural progression that just, you know, when this particular district became, and really this district was a combination of part of what used to be the old 75th, part of what used to be the old 76th, and I believe I want to say like the 78th that became the newly created 77th.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we're going back to things like the Voting Rights Act of 1965, wherein there was federal efforts to try to see that you had more blacks voting mm-hmm. and that you had more black elected officials. So as a part of the federal efforts to see that across the United States that there were districts that were designed in such a way that blacks were more able to be elected, so when this district was designed in such a way that it had a larger number of black voters in the district, one of my friends, who is now deceased, a young man by the name of Michael Rankins, who had also worked with me many times trying to help me help other people mm-hmm. in campaigns, kept urging me to run, and I kept saying, Michael, I don't have the time, I can't practice law and teach and do that, and I just don't have the time. And Mike kept saying, you've got to. Well, Michael and I had worked extremely hard in Judge Gary Payne's district court race for district judge. And so when, you know, the time came, it would have been in 1991, I guess. It would have been the fall of 91. Michael kept urging me that, Jesse, you ought to run. And I kept saying, Michael, ain't no way in the world I've got, you know, the time to do it, because, you know, I'm working as hard as I can trying to practice law and teach. And he said, oh, you've got to. And the reason that it became a priority for Michael was because you had to file by the filing deadline. So I told Michael, I said, well, Michael, I'll think about it. And that was the thing. As soon as I said I'd think about it, then it became his ability to keep coming back saying, you got to do what you got to do.
Keep coming back. Mm-hmm.
So I first told him I'd let him know by November what I decided. In November, I told him no. And he says, oh, you got to. So I said, okay, Michael, I'll let you know by December. And so finally, you know, we kept going back and forth, and I ultimately filed and, you know, mm-hmm. and ran.
Mm-hmm. If I could go back to the issue of the preacher committee for a minute, in terms of the actual experiences of those meetings, do you have any particular memories or stories about that experience? Was it how would you characterize the experience of the meetings?
Sometimes you confuse me with your questions. What do you mean by the experience?
Well,
are you talking about content? Are you talking about interactions with other members of the committee?
I'm really talking about both of those two things.
Well,
the seriousness of the discussions.
Oh, yes. The discussions were extremely focused on how do we make Kentucky a much better place in terms of education.
Mm-hmm.
I stated earlier about Lois Weinberg, Lois Combs Weinberg, being on the Pritchard Committee. I mean, you had people who were genuinely, Joy Hembree was on there, and I can't remember which sequence. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people, some of whom came and went, and then there were others. Wade Mons was on there for years and may still be. And you had people who were very, very serious about trying to make the state of Kentucky the best educational state that there is. And so I hate to keep jumping away from the Pritchard Committee, but like, take when we looked at House Bill 1 and the changes that are made now in higher education mm-hmm. in Kentucky, the seriousness with which educational issues were studied, that was the kind of thing that was going on at the Pritchard Committee, that someday there ought to be this very serious focus on Kentucky performing well educationally in students and persons from Kentucky. The kinds of things that we did in House Bill 1 where we compared North Carolina's system, and I mean, Mr. Pritchard had experts and consultants coming from all parts of the country, and Bob Sexton and them being the ones who carried out the day-to-day getting them here.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We had people coming in all the time showing us what had been done in other states and how we ought to do this or we could do the other.
And how well did you think that the committee addressed issues of like racial equity?
Well, good question. It was not discussed to the kind of degree that I think you're saying that an equity, I mean, there were discussions about the number of blacks that were in were seeking higher educational degrees. There were discussions about some of the problems that might need to be addressed,
mm-hmm.
but it never rose to the level of an equity kind of task force kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
if that's what you're asking.
Well, I guess a different way of saying this would be, did you feel that it adequately addressed issues of like racial injustices?
Well, you know, I think our country has a real, no, I don't think our country ever has addressed the problems of race in America in a way that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we address it in kind of like Mr. Kimball did. My God, we got to do something. He's about to sue.
Right.
Well, in the same kind of way, we address it all the time that way. When we went to the dean of the law school and said, you've never had a black professor, it's like, oh my God, we got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I go back 4 years later and I say, you know, you've had one and you haven't gone out on your own and gotten a second one. And they say, oh my God, now that you've brought it up, let's do something. Well, we do the same thing in almost everything. You know, I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in 1978. Well, since then, to the best of my knowledge, One fellow came as I was leaving, and there's been one additional since then, so they're up to two.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going from 78. I left in July 31st of 1980, and now we're at 2001, and I don't think there's more than two there. If there's more than two, it might be three at the local office. And I'm not saying that anybody is out there saying, oh my God, we're going to discriminate and we're going to specifically bar the door and keep black lawyers out. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying I just don't think in America we ever look at this is a country where we're going to make sure that we get large numbers of women and blacks in positions mm-hmm. of power and authority.
Mm-hmm.
The Kentucky General Assembly right now has, I believe, four blacks.
Mm-hmm.
The Kentucky Senate has won, and I don't see large recruiting efforts to say, let's see how we can increase the pool by 25 blacks.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in law school, one of the things that we did was try to recruit black law students.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, when I first went to law school, there were three blacks in my first year class. There were like six in the whole school. I went to the military after the end of my first year. I got drafted and had to go away and come back. When I came back, there were like 15 black law students, and it was just astounding to me that there was that degree of increase.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? I graduated in December of 1973, and if you go out to UK's College of Law right now, I'll bet money you won't find 20 black law students.
Mm-hmm. I bet you won't.
Now, is that an intentional racial discrimination?
Right.
Is that appropriately affecting equity? No, it's not appropriately affecting equity if you're defining equity in terms of how many black lawyers do you plan to have in the state.
Mm-hmm. Representativeness.
There are something like in the state of Kentucky, and please forgive me if I misquote this, but I think there are five black judges in the state of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
There's two here in Fayette County. I think there's something like two in Louisville and one on the Kentucky Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
In the whole state,
mm-hmm.
you know, there are like 270, I think, I hope my numbers are right, I may be wrong and that may be way too high. But anyway, there's five black judges out of 270 judges. Now I'm correct on that. In terms of black lawyers, out of the thousands and thousands of black lawyers, they're not there.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers are mm-hmm. very small.
Mm-hmm.
Now how do you get more black lawyers? You get more black lawyers by getting more black law students.
Right.
How do you get more black law students? One of the things, as I said, if UK has three black law professors now, the highest I've ever known was three.
Mm-hmm.
I helped make that where we got up to two.
Right.
I don't think that right now they have but two.
Mm-hmm.
I broke the thing in 74. We're at 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Two in 78, and we're two now.
Well, we're about out of time, but I might as well stop the tape right.
That's
here,
fine.
But I...